From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Bankruptcy has historically been the symbol of financial rock bottom in the USA, the legal restart button when you go broke and start over. It's never been pretty, but it's been a lot better than debtor's prison. For at least a decade, the banking industry has been fighting to change the terms of personal bankruptcy, arguing that debts shouldn't go away just because you can't pay them, and that too many Americans have abused the system. Today, the U.S. Senate began debate again on whether to toughen the U.S. bankruptcy laws to keep people paying off old debt long after they've gone under. In the American credit card nation of uncertain employment and big medical bills, the impact of tougher bankruptcy laws may be closer to you than you think. Tonight on Point, the drive on Capitol Hill to toughen the rules of bankruptcy, who wins, who loses, and who's pushing for change. We begin tonight in Washington. Maura Reynolds is congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her who's been pushing this bill so hard and why.
Well, it's been pushed for close to a decade now by the financial services industry, banks and credit card companies. And the main reason is that many people declare bankruptcy and never pay their credit card bills. And so the credit card companies would like to get more of the revenue that they're expecting.
So how much tougher would this legislation make bankruptcy? If you went bankrupt, what would happen under this bill that doesn't happen now?
Well, what it would do is it would force you to disclose, go through a more complicated disclosure process of what your assets are. And if you make more than the median income in your state, which is somewhere around $40,000 to $50,000 in most states in the country, then if you made less than that, you could file under Chapter 7, which means that your debts would be largely erased and you could start over. If you made more than that, then you would have to come up with a payment plan that the courts would approve and to pay back at least a portion of your debt.
And what's the argument here about the American bankruptcy system? Are they saying it's too lenient, more lenient than other nations? And if so, how did it become so lenient?
This legislation was introduced at a time that credit card companies were losing money because the numbers of Americans who were filing for bankruptcy was going up astronomically in the mid to late 90s. And this was meant to give the credit card companies some relief, especially since the bankruptcy courts were overwhelmed and many people, even those with many assets, were being automatically put into Chapter 7 and having their debts erased. So the idea was that more Americans who had at least some assets should pay at least some of their debts. And the other argument that the credit card companies made was that the forfeited debts got passed on to all the rest of the consumers who were paying their bills in the forms of higher fees and higher interest rates, and that this was in nobody's long-term interest. So there were definitely some problems that needed to be addressed, and this legislation came out of that argument.
So it's easy to see why the banks would like to see people held to account. What about the opposition to this change in bankruptcy law? What are opponents saying?
Well, the opponents say that things have changed since the mid-90s when this bill was originally written and that the economy is much worse and the reasons why people are going into debt have changed. There's some data out of Harvard University that suggests that at least half or more of all bankruptcies are caused in part by medical bills and by other health problems and lack of health insurance. Clearly, then, the problem isn't that the person was, you know, off spending money at the mall. It was that they got sick and couldn't pay their doctor. Senator Kennedy and some other senators would like to make an exception in this new code for medical bills and give some special considerations for people who've had medical misfortunes. That is not in the bill in its current form. Another problem, for instance, is that some of the soldiers who have been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, who were small businessmen, they've had a number of bankruptcies of their businesses while they've been gone and unable to take care of their businesses. There's no exception in the current legislation for that, and some of the opponents of the Democrats think that the bill as it's currently written penalizes hardworking Americans who've had misfortunes or have served their country, and that some adjustments need to be made.
Maura, how are the politics of this legislation playing out? I see some very prominent Democrats, Joe Biden, Delaware, of course, many credit card companies headquartered there, but Dianne Feinstein, California, Herb Kohl of Wisconsin, all voted in committee for this legislation. So it's bipartisan support?
Well, Democrats are split on it. Some Democrats do think that that there would be a lot of benefits from the bill. For instance, it would make child support and alimony payments top priority for debtors. Proponents would argue that this would help women and children, especially those of modest means, to retain their income. So there are provisions like that that appeal to some Democrats. And, of course, Joe Biden is from a state where the vast majority of credit card companies are headquartered, Delaware. That would help explain why he's a supporter of the bill.
And right in the middle of this, there is unexpectedly an abortion issue. What is that? Why is it there? How's it being dealt with?
Well, it's there because about the same time that the legislation started working its way through Congress, and it did pass, and this provision was adopted in a compromise form 2 years ago.
So the provision being?
That anti-abortion protesters who rack up court fines for blocking abortion clinics cannot declare bankruptcy to get rid of those court fines. That if they declare bankruptcy, they still need to pay their court damages. This was something that started happening about the same time that the bill started working its way through Congress. You had several prominent anti-abortion activists, including Randall Terry, the founder of Operation Rescue, who declared bankruptcy in order to avoid getting out of paying the fees under the Access to Abortion Clinics Act. And so Senator Schumer of New York, who was a sponsor of that act, offered an amendment, which, as I said, was adopted in a compromise form, that said that these kinds of court damages would not be, as the jargon puts it, discharged under bankruptcy.
So did that hold up the legislation somehow?
Well, it did. What happened was eventually a compromise version, which did not mention abortion and simply said that court fines from blocking access to legal services could not be discharged under bankruptcy. That was approved by a number of abortion foes, including perhaps the most influential of them, Representative Henry Hyde of Illinois. But when it went to the floor of the House, a number of members of the pro-life caucus, the anti-abortion caucus, balked and basically blocked the bill from coming to a vote in the House. This was in 2002, and so that killed it for that year. When the bill was reintroduced this year, the number of abortion foes in the House has only increased in the last two elections. And so Senator Charles Grassley, who's the current sponsor of the bill in the Senate, took out that provision. So there's no abortion clinic language in the bill as it's currently written.
So right now, abortion protesters could, in effect, escape fines by declaring bankruptcy, as the bill's written currently.
Well, yes and no, because there are other provisions that will get to them. For instance, there are other parts of the bankruptcy code that will allow you, with much additional litigation, to track down their assets. Randall Terry was forced to make payments towards his court fines, but it's a very arduous process. It involves a lot of litigation, usually in many states all at once, in small courts, and it's something that the abortion rights community feels is arduous and not fair.
Sounds like a delicate balance there. In the meantime, are people expecting this legislation tightening bankruptcy laws to be passed this time?
Well, no one is quite sure. There's an awful lot of counting going on Capitol Hill right now, counting up votes pro and con, with and without various amendments and provisions. And the situation is not clear, and hopefully it will clarify in the next few days. The Senate has set aside this entire week to debate the provisions, and there's an awful lot of back-scenes negotiating going on even as we speak. So this will all be getting clarified in the next few days.
So still up in the air on Capitol Hill. Maura Reynolds, wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about the latest push on Capitol Hill to toughen American bankruptcy laws. You can join the conversation. Where do you stand on the issue? Is American bankruptcy law too lenient, an easy way out for careless spenders? Or is it a safety valve for people trying to hold strapped families together, a fair restart? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We've got a lot of folks we're going to be talking tonight about this, with big investments in this one way and another. But first, joining me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, I trust you're solvent tonight.
That wouldn't withstand scrutiny, believe me.
So here, I mean, bankruptcy is such an interesting idea. It acknowledges the fact that at some point, for a long time, society has said there is a point at which we're prepared to forgive debts so that citizens can get a fresh start, not molder away in debtor's prison, become productive citizens again. But there's this big push to say it's been too lenient. It's got to be tightened up in this country.
Well, indeed, it's been a source of American entrepreneurship. You know, in 1820, 1,400 Bostonians went to jail for debt. And one man went to jail for 6 years owing $50.
Ouch!
It was the Jacksonians. It was the democratization that started in the 1820s and then took momentum under Jackson that really changed these laws and made them more liberal. And there's no question but that it contributed to American entrepreneurship.
But then once you get into an era of easy plastic, easy credit card debt, very easy to go too far.
It is, but you know, let's be candid. If debtors had a PAC, this thing wouldn't pass. There's one PAC.
That is a political action committee.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, the financial service industry is among the biggest givers to Congress. 2/3 of the money last year went to Republicans, but big Democrats like Harry Reid, Bayh, Dodd, they got a lot too. We'll have to see how they vote. But again, if debtors could give, you'd see a different vote.
A different story. Jack, stand by. We're going to take a short break here and dive on in. We're talking tonight about the drive on Capitol Hill to sharply toughen American bankruptcy laws. We're looking at who wins, who loses, who's pushing the harder line on bankruptcy. Where do you stand? Do you want a tougher line on people who file for bankruptcy? Or do you fear that vulnerable Americans will be crushed to safeguard the interests of the banks? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the drive on Capitol Hill in Washington to sharply toughen American bankruptcy laws. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think as you listen to this? Is lenient bankruptcy law the price we pay to support the risk-taking society? Maybe the risk-taking society that George Bush says he celebrates, the ownership society. Or is American bankruptcy law too lenient, an easy way out for careless spenders? Or is it the safety valve for people just trying to hold strapped families together? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is with us tonight. We'll be hearing in just a few minutes from a representative from the American banking industry. I'm joined right now from Washington by Ed Merzwinski. He is program director for Consumer Affairs at U.S. PIRG. That's the National Office of the Public Interest Research Group. It's a watchdog and consumer advocacy organization. Ed Merzwinski, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So here we're looking at this, and we want to try and make a fair judgment on this. It's easy to imagine that with all the easy credit out there in the last 10 or 20 years, some people may have just, you know, gotten caught up in spending at the mall and lost track of it and don't deserve to be bailed out. How do you see it, Ed?
I think consumer groups, women's organizations, civil rights groups, labor unions, bankruptcy professors, and anyone not connected with the financial industry who looks at this in a detached way says the bankruptcy system is reasonable today. It offers people a chance to reorganize their debts. Chapter 7, where you do get a fresh start from some of your debts, or Chapter 13, where you have a longer repayment schedule, are both incredible stigmas on people. You only file for bankruptcy when you're desperate. 90% plus of the time, you file for medical reasons or because you got divorced or because you got laid off. It is not an easy thing.
90% of the time for those three reasons. Yet I see here in the last year, Ed, something like almost 1.6 million Americans filed for bankruptcy in the year that ended last June 30th. Now, that's slightly down, very slightly down from the year before after a long uptick. That's a lot of bankruptcies. But are you saying that 90% of that is reasonable, justified, that a fair observer would say, yes, I understand bankruptcy was necessary here?
I absolutely think, and consumer groups believe, that bankruptcies are up, but they're up First of all, as you pointed out, they're down slightly, and we don't think they'll continue to go up. But they're up, and so is credit card debt. Credit card debt has skyrocketed. In 25 years, it's gone from something like $50 billion to three-quarters of $1 trillion, over $750 billion.
So whose fault is that?
Well, the credit card industry has made easy credit available, and they've already collected a lot of money from consumers in the form of high interest rates. You'll notice that when Mr. Greenspan for many years was lowering interest rates and the real estate and other interest rates were declining, the credit card rates did not decline anywhere near as much, and they kept increasing their late fees, adding penalty interest rates.
Have to do that to cover the number of people who were...
That's what they say, but it's really... I mean, credit card industry is the most profitable form of the banking industry. They made more money last year than they made in any year since 1988, according to number... I mean, it's just unbelievable how much money they're making in the credit card industry, yet they continue to pile more fees, more penalties on consumers.
And what about this legislation, Ed Mrozinski? Where are your concerns? What would it require of people who go bankrupt that it doesn't require now?
Well, two problems. The first problem is it does nothing to rein in the unfair credit card practices that state attorneys general and even the bank regulators are starting to get concerned with, yet Congress is afraid to take that industry on. But second, the bankruptcy bill is unnecessary. There already is a standard for abuse of the bankruptcy laws. We don't need a new one. The changes to the means test in this bill that would basically take away the right of a fresh start for more debtors, force them into a repayment plan, Chapter 13.
That is, if they make median, sort of medium income or above.
What they do in that test, Tom, is they take away all the discretion of the bankruptcy experts, the bankruptcy judges, and they give it to the Congress. The Congress is essentially taking what the credit card industry asked them to do, putting it into law, taking away all the discretion of the judges. So,
but Ed, put in simple terms what that would mean. If I owe a lot of money, I've gone bankrupt, but it doesn't wipe my debt away. What, I have a new payment plan worked out under the law. I pay for how long, how much? Endlessly?
Well, more and more people would have to pay off their debts for 5 years, and that's primarily by putting people from Chapter 7 into Chapter 13. Mm-hmm. And again, I want to point out they're both unfair in a lot of ways. They both impose a stigma on consumers, and in neither one do you write off all of your debts.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of this bill is the credit card companies want you to pay them more. And so the changes that are being made mean that you'll pay for a longer period of time, even if you can't afford to pay off those debts. Even
right.
if you could only pay off a tiny amount of your credit card debts, you would be forced into a draconian payment reschedule. We say, you know, you referred, or I think Jack referred to the old debtor's prison.
Mm.
This bill is effectively creates a debtor's prison without walls.
So on a home release. Ed Mrozinski, stand by. I want to get a voice of the banking industry in here because they've been making a lot of noise about this for a long time. We're joined from Washington by Ed Yingling. He's Executive Vice President of the American Bankers Association. Ed, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
So let us hear the case that the banking industry is making on Capitol Hill. Why do we need tougher bankruptcy laws?
Well, the bill that Ed Mrozinski just described is not really the bill that's on the Senate floor. If it were, it wouldn't have passed the Senate last time around with 85 votes. Senator Hillary Clinton wouldn't have voted for it, and she did. Senator Chuck Schumer wouldn't have voted for it, and he did. There's been a lot of talk here tonight about the credit card industry, but we ought to look at who is behind this bill. As we speak, there are several thousand representatives of the credit union industry that are on the Hill lobbying for it. One of the witnesses last week from the credit union industry talked about the fact that his credit union had lost $2,000 to bankruptcy, and this is a very small credit union, in 1996, lost $115,000 in 2003. Lots of small business people are lobbying for it. Small banks are lobbying for it.
And make the case. Why, Ed? Why do you see...
The bill really stands for a very simple proposition. You've correctly pointed out that the changes really only apply to those above median income.
Of course, that's not exactly rich, but still, it's not in dire poverty.
I would agree with what Ed Merzinski said at the beginning, that the great, great majority of people have bankruptcy for reasons that are difficult, like medical problems.
So would this hold them down, keep a foot on their neck when they're trying to get restarted?
Absolutely not. If you're below median income, you are entitled automatically to Chapter 7, automatically. Okay. You have all your debts wiped out, with certain exceptions like taxes and child support.
Let me just ask, is that a change, taxes and child support? Are those currently wiped out?
No, there's some reordering, so the child support actually is strengthened.
Okay.
But basically, that's the current rule. There are some provisions in there that you have to show your income. You can't commit fraud.
Right.
If you're above median income, then the test is fairly simple. You go to the judge. The judge looks at your income and looks at your debts and determines if you have the ability to pay something. The problem is now you have rich people, fairly wealthy people, say a doctor or a lawyer, that run up bills and then go to bankruptcy court and get all their debts wiped out.
And what's the scale of that problem currently?
It's not a huge scale in terms of numbers. My estimate based on looking at a number of studies is it's probably 5% that could afford to pay something and aren't. But remember, it is unfair kind of morally for people like that not to pay when we have millions of people that are working hard every day to pay.
But people just at median or above, they're a long way from rich in this country, as you well know, and this is going to make it tougher on them, too. What's the logic in that? If they're making $40,000,
$50,000. Can I finish?
Of course.
The logic is that if they are able to pay something, they ought to pay something. And if they're not, then the judge says, fine, all your debts are wiped out. But remember, when somebody who can afford to pay something doesn't pay, it means that all the rest of us pay. Because
all your debts are wiped out, Ed? All your debts?
Ed Merzinski, let me just ask you there. If they can afford to pay something, they ought to pay something. It sounds reasonable. What's your response?
The industry, first of all, by the way, it's like when you've got a vampire, you hold the garlic up in front of you. The credit card industry holds the credit unions up in front of them to hide behind them, and we're disappointed in the credit unions. But the fact is, I said in the beginning, and you will say again, people that can afford to pay should pay, but this bill takes people that can't afford to pay and forces them to pay anyway, and it puts them in debtor's prison instead of giving them a fresh start. I know that sounds like a soundbite, but what we're saying is even if you could only afford to pay the credit card company off a very small amount, and it would not in any way come close to paying your debts off, you'd be forced to not be able to get a fresh start. It's the same thing as a debtor's prison. It takes away the safety net that the law is supposed to provide. And as for the child support, getting some kind of preferential treatment in this bill,
which is why I think some Democrats have signed up for it.
Women's groups still against it? Because they don't believe that.
I want to get our callers in here. A lot of them have been waiting to join. Bill is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you. I come as someone who has had problems with this.
Have you filed bankruptcy, Bill?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
We started out with credit counseling, which was helpful.
Yep.
The companies were very helpful in basically eliminating the interest rate so we could pay it back. But then later on, we did have some problems with medical bills and that, which did eventually force us into bankruptcy. I mean, I think in some regards it is a little bit too easy, but perhaps they should revise it where maybe people are, put into credit counseling first before, they just decide, well, let me just eliminate.
Bill, let me ask, did you go into Chapter 7? Did you have all your debt wiped away?
Yes, yes.
And have you changed your ways since then? Are you avoiding debt now?
Well, definitely. I mean, after the first problem we had, we were trying to, you know, keep our debt under control. But
right.
as I said, we had some, you know, with kids and that, you have medical issues, and, you know, our medical bill just went right through the ceiling.
When you look back, do you feel that you had acted irresponsibly before you went bankrupt, or you did your best, you acted reasonably, and it couldn't be avoided?
Well, we did, like I said, we did have trouble at first, and then
yeah.
we got over that, and then we were trying to do things reasonably, but, you know, we were still, you know, we had incurred some debt, but it wasn't, you know, a very significant part. We were able to make it on our income.
So here you are, you actually filed bankruptcy, it helped you out, but you're saying anyway that you think it's too easy to go bankrupt.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's lawyers who specialize in it, you know, they just basically guarantee this is going to be no problem for you. And it was a very simple process.
Did you feel a stigma? Did your relatives, neighbors look down on you afterward, Bill?
No, not really. The funny thing was is that before we filed bankruptcy, you know, we would have problems getting credit. But after we filed bankruptcy, we were getting things in the mail from the credit card companies all the time, you know, offering us credit.
Oh,
you know?
Boy. What a crazy old mixed up upside down world. But Bill,
yeah.
thank you for calling with your story. Ed Yingling, is that your worst nightmare right there?
Well, at first, I think that is a very interesting call and raises a question that you talked about, and that is medical bills. And I don't think anybody involved in this process believes that if a family is hit with heavy medical bills and first loses their job, or even if they don't lose employment, just can't afford to pay it, that they shouldn't have a complete fresh start. They should. And that's always been contemplated in the bill. If there was a weakness in the bill, there was an amendment adopted in committee to address it. So clearly things like medical bills can cause people to go into bankruptcy.
And will they still be protected whether or not they're above the median income level?
If they're below median, it's automatic, as
yep.
I mentioned. If
yep.
it's above median, then they go to the judge, and the judge says, let me see your income and how your wealth, and put that on one side of the balance
mm-hmm.
sheet, and let me see your debts, and that would certainly explicitly include the medical debts. And the judge looks and says, well, you can't really afford to pay anything. You go over to Chapter 7, or it may be that you have somebody that can afford to pay something over time.
So an element of discretion there. I want to quickly welcome into our conversation here from Boston, David Himmelstein. He is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's author of a recent report pointing out that an awful lot of bankruptcies are due to medical issues. David, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
What did you find in your Harvard study on this? What percentage of bankruptcies did you find were attributed to some kind of medical bills?
Well, it depends on the exact definition you use, but between about 46% and 54%. 46% if you use a really strict definition, 54% if you include people who had a little bit wider problems like substance abuse or some psychiatric problems.
But either way, that's a very high percentage of bankruptcies chalked up to health problems.
Right. About 750,000 families each year, which is about 2 million people in those families, are financially ruined by health problems.
Did you go ahead, David, and look at this new legislation? Do you support tightening these rules up, given that perspective you got from your recent study, or not?
Oh, I think it'd be a disaster. What we saw is people arriving in ruin in the bankruptcy courts, and that's where we interviewed people. These were not people finding an easy way out. These were desperate people.
But you heard Ed Yingling say the judge can look at their finances and decide whether they can pay some of those medical bills.
Well, and for a woman who's going through a divorce and whose husband won't produce their past tax returns, they can't even get to the judge because she won't be able to produce the paperwork necessary to file under this bill. And the bill basically is a free ride for the very wealthy people. He pretends to be against and penalize many of the poor people who are really desperate. So, for instance, if you have a judgment against you as a corporate executive for fraud in your business, that you're excused from under these laws.
That's not true. That is not true.
Well, the bill voted out of committee was.
That is
and
not
in
true.
The, and in the states that allow you to keep millions of dollars of home equity, this law would allow that to continue, too.
Tightens it up. That's not true.
Ed Yingling, I'm going to come to you, and we'll go to both of those issues. I just got David for a couple of more seconds here. David, before, if we don't have a better health coverage in this country, is bankruptcy kind of the safety valve for people when their health goes bad and they can't afford the treatment?
Unfortunately, it does end up being the safety valve for many people. And what's really striking to us is that a lot of these people had insurance. These were middle-class Americans basically doing everything right. They'd graduated college, many of them. They'd owned homes. What happened was they got sick. They lost their jobs. They lost their health insurance coverage because they got too sick to work, and they ended up in desperate financial condition.
And
the only
right
way
now,
out...
Right into bankruptcy. David Himmelstein, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. We're talking tonight about the drive on Capitol Hill to sharply toughen American bankruptcy law. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the drive on Capitol Hill to sharply toughen American bankruptcy laws, about who wins, who loses, who's pushing the harder line on bankruptcy. You can join us tonight. Where do you stand? Have American banks made their own bed here by raining credit cards down on the nation? If scarce health care puts millions of American families one injury away from bankruptcy, should bankruptcy be punitive? Will tougher bankruptcy laws make Americans pull up their socks and take more responsibility for their personal finances? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight from Washington by Ed Yingling, Executive Vice President of the American Bankers Association. We've got to get to him in just a moment here. By Ed Merzwinski. He is Program Director at U.S. PIRG in Washington. Also, our own Jack Beattie is with us. Joel is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Joel. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, I just was recently reading an article, an interview with Warren Buffett, and he was talking about bankruptcy. That is, I think it was his sister or sister-in-law. I don't want to misspeak.
But a close relative of one of the richest men in the world.
Exactly, who you think would know, you know, an awful lot about finance and bankruptcy. She got herself into pretty bad financial straits, and he declined to bail her out.
Okay,
and
so?
His argument was that bailing her out and helping her avoid bankruptcy doesn't help anyone except for the banks who gave her too much credit and got her into that mess to begin with.
So you took that as a criticism of easy credit. What do you think about the overall toughening, Joel? Are you for it or against it?
Well, I think it's, you know, the devil's in the details, and unfortunately I'm not as familiar as I should be perhaps with the details. But, you know, if you looked at – if you imagine dramatically reducing the restrictions on bankruptcy, basically anyone, you know, sign here and you're bankrupt.
Yeah.
I got to believe you're going to get a lot fewer pre-approved credit card offers in the mail addressed to people who really shouldn't be getting those things in the first place.
And if you go the other way and make it tougher, you're kind of suggesting you may get more credit card offers.
You're
because
going to get more credit card offers, and you know, but it, you know, a big part of our economy is easy access to capital. So,
yeah.
You know, what people like to look for, you know, quick sound bites, quick answers. But I think, you know, on the one hand, you're going to have a lot of people in, you know, effectively debtor's prison. On the other hand, you've got, you know, you want to have access to capital to small businesses.
Yeah, it's a complicated chemistry. Joel, thanks very much for your call. Ed Yingling, how about it? What is the right balance here? I mean, you have to have some kind of level of forgiveness to keep the wheels of all this turning. We don't want debtor's prisons. And people have pointed out, Senator Kennedy the other day, saying the banking industry, Ed Merzwinski is saying tonight, the banking industry is making quite good profits, thank you, the credit card companies. So how do you calculate where the right, you know, degree of toughness is in bankruptcy?
Well, I think the devil is in the details, as your caller just said. And I think it's important, again, to look at what's actually in the bill as opposed to some of the rhetoric and spin you hear about it. So let's go back to the basics. If your median income or below, and that's maybe 80% of the filers, you go to court, you bring something that shows your income, you don't commit fraud, and what your earlier caller talked about credit counseling, there is a provision in the bill, it was not advocated by us, but that requires credit counseling. So for the great majority of filers, it's automatic. You get, with certain exceptions like taxes and child support, you get your debt wiped out. For those above median income, you go to the judge, you bring in your income and that type of thing, and on the other side you bring in your debts, including your medical debts, and the judge looks at it and says, I think you cannot afford to pay anything, so move on, or the judge looks at it and says, you can afford to pay something, so I'm going to ask you to pay 20% over the next few years.
Now, you heard our guest, Dr. Himmelstein, saying that he fears that people, for example, a woman in the process of divorce, won't be able to bring in that paperwork. She'll be stuck with the medical bills. The judge isn't going to help her out. I heard you objecting to that characterization.
Well, first I'd point out that we don't disagree with the general proposition of that study, but I'd point out that the co-author of that study, Professor Elizabeth Warren, is probably the primary opponent of this bill, so I'm not
that,
sure.
That's an outrageous assumption. She's an opponent of the bill, but she is also an academic widely respected with a number of peer-reviewed studies.
I'm just stating a fact, Ed.
It doesn't, I guess, take away from her research if she opposes the bill.
No,
maybe she opposes it because of the
research.
I don't
disagree with the basic principle.
But speak to Dr. Himmelstein's point that you may have people who will not be protected by the provisions you describe.
Well, it's a little hard to say that. I mean, his point was somebody may not have the documentation to show what their income is. It's a little hard to say that somebody asking for bankruptcy relief, full relief, shouldn't have to have some documentation to show their income. I don't quite know how you overcome that unless you're just going to say, as the previous caller alluded to, anybody walks in and says, I don't want to pay my debts, and walks out and doesn't have to pay.
Mm. Ed Mrzewinski, we've got Ed Yingling saying 80% plus of people who filing for bankruptcy are going to be below that median, and the other 20 deserve some scrutiny from a judge who can decide whether they can pay.
The point of this bill is to take away the judge's authority in most of the circumstances. The means test in the bill is based on IRS rules for tax cheats. And it says if you have $100 more in income every month than the IRS would allow a taxpayer who's delinquent to keep, you'd have to be in the 5-year repayment plan.
Right.
You would not be able to have tuition expenses for private or parochial school more than $1,500 a year. If you owned a car, you would not be able to take public transportation. I mean, I could go on and on about the means test, but it's really not based on living expenses. It's based on really unfair tax cheat rules. And as for the medical debt issues, I would ask the American Bankers Association, why is Senator Kennedy, if this bill is so fair to people that have medical debt, why is Senator Kennedy so concerned, and will the bankers support his amendment that would allow the court to take into account special medical circumstances that led to bankruptcy?
Ed Yingling?
Well, I think the bill does address it, but if there needs to be some fine-tuning, fine, we'll support it. The bill, the law should take into account fully any medical debt or any medical cost that a consumer has, absolutely.
Jack Beatty, you've been listening to this whole conversation. I mean, it really is a fascinating one, the country with itself, with some with bigger megaphones than others, about the right balance here, the right incentives, the right relief to be humane, be merciful, and keep everything running along here.
Yes, but, you know, this is prima facie evidence for those who need it that the priorities in our politics are corporate and financial. And this is a bill that this industry wants. They have, in effect, paid for it by lavishly subsidizing politicians in both parties. And they are probably going to get it. And if the average person out there thinks that the credit card companies and the banks have their interest at heart, then they're not living in the same world, say, as Robert Manning, who wrote a book called Credit Card Nation, which pointed out that in the 1990s, these credit card companies overcharged consumers by about $300 billion. So these are the people who do that. To be sure, people are profligate with credit cards. But on the other hand, the credit card companies are promiscuous in the way they hand them out. So it's they want people to get into debt, but not too much debt.
And keep making those payments. Come hell or high water. Gene's calling from Boston. Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Sure. My perspective on this, I actually have an acquaintance and a very close friend who in the past 12 months have, told me that they have actually gone into bankruptcy.
And what do you learn from their experience, Jean?
Well, I feel either I'm being, let me put it this way. I graduate from graduate school in May.
Yeah.
I will be paying probably for the next 15 years, unless I take a 20-year repayment plan, the $50,000 that I chose to take out as a loan, I wasn't buying a TV or VCR, I was buying my education.
Right.
I went into that knowing I need to pay them. My plans after I graduate have to include the fact that the car I buy, the apartment I live on, live in, the vacations I take, all have something to do with the fact that I have a responsibility to pay back this money that I used.
And you think your friends sort of copped out on their responsibility?
Well,
it wasn't a medical issue or a
they
job?
They were not. Neither one of them. And to tell you the truth, it's difficult for me to even respond when it comes to financial matters with them because one of them is still getting manicures and pedicures, something that I consider a huge treat and I do maybe on my birthday.
Right.
Another person is living in a $1,300 apartment now.
And so you look over there, you've got your $50,000 in graduate school debt, and you say, wait a minute. Ed Mrzwinski, how do you respond to that critical view that Jeans brings?
There are a small number of people who may abuse the system, but 90% of the people have medical debts. They get divorced in a situation where it was a lifestyle change that shocked them into having to file for bankruptcy, or they get laid off. And a lot of the time, their cause of being laid off or their cause of their problem might have been, you know, something to do with the economy, corporate scandals, their own company filed for bankruptcy, their pension plan went kaput, all of these problems out there. But these are not reasons to take away the safety net. The judges currently have the authority to treat these cases on a case-by-case basis. The fundamental point of this bill is to take away the right of judges to determine which Americans should be able to take advantage of the safety net and which ones are forced into a debtor's prison. That's really the problem with it.
Ed Yingling, do you smell victory here for the bankers' push to toughen it up, or is it still an open question?
Well, first, I agree that the great majority of people going through bankruptcy have those kinds of problems, and they should get complete relief. I think the previous caller is pointing out that the current system doesn't work quite right, and so there do need to be some changes. The judges, in not every case, but because there has become kind of a legal factory, the judges just let all these cases go through for people that can afford to pay something. And so part of the idea here is to make the judges actually have to make some calculations. They'll still have some discretion.
We just got a few seconds. How do you handicap it? Do you think it's coming your way this time, Ed?
I think it's highly likely to be enacted. It has had huge majorities in the House and Senate before. It has tended to be sidelined by issues that are not really bankruptcy reform issues.
Right, we heard about those.
Right.
With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Ed Yingling at the American Bankers Association, thank you very much
for being with us.
Thank
you, Tom.
And Ed Mrzwinski at U.S. PIRG, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, it doesn't sound like a kinder, gentler nation coming down the pike.
Oh, boy. Especially if you get in trouble with medical bills. On the other hand,
stay off the plastic, Jack. I'm afraid we're out of time. Thanks for being with us. In a moment, a sign of relief from the reporter who broke the story of the BTK killer. This is On Point. Residents of Wichita, Kansas, are breathing easier this week after the arrest of a man accused of being the so-called BTK serial killer who terrorized the city for 3 decades. Dennis Rader is being held on $10 million bail and is expected to appear in court tomorrow. He will be charged with 10 murders between 1974 and 1991. The BTK killer became known for sending letters to police and the news media detailing the gruesome nature of his crimes. Kathy Henkel was a young reporter in Wichita in 1974 when she got her hands on a letter BTK wrote describing his first murders. She broke the story that a serial killer was on the loose. Tonight in this radio diary, Kathy Henkel recalls the harrowing words of that letter and describes the relief she feels that BTK may finally be behind bars.
The letter still burns in my hands. 30 years later, the words of a madman are still horrifying to read. How he killed a family of 4, binding and strangling each one. The 11-year-old girl had been hung from a pipe in the basement. Her parents and 9-year-old brother strangled in their bedrooms. All just a mile from where I grew up in Wichita, Kansas. Afterward, he would type the 2-page letter and include every detail of his killing spree. What kind of knot he used on each, what clothes they wore, how he left their bodies, and the souvenirs he took, the boy's radio, the father's watch. He tucked his letter in a book at the downtown public library, The police retrieved it on a tip, then kept it secret for months, even though the killer said he was stalking his next victim, preparing to kill again. He was begging for attention. That's when, as a 26-year-old reporter, I obtained a copy of the letter from a trusted source, one who stays anonymous to this day. The newspaper I work for published the story, revealing that a serial killer was ready to strike again and that police were keeping it quiet. In the letter, his sentences were clipped, his grammar poor, his words misspelled, but his message was numbing. Here is one excerpt. "When this monster enters my brain, I will never know, but it here to stay. Society can be thankful that there are ways for people like me to relieve myself by daydreams of some victim being tortured and being mine. In a big, complicated game, my friend, the monster play, putting victims' number down, follow them, checking up on them, waiting in the dark, waiting, waiting. Maybe you can stop him. I can't. He has already chosen his next victim." He signed it, "Yours truly, guiltily," adding that his code name would be BTK for bind, torture, kill. Police say now there were 10 murders, maybe more. The killer sent letters, drawings, and poems to the media taunting the police, and then he stopped writing for 25 years. Last March, he broke his silence, sending letters again to the media and leaving packets around the city containing trinkets he had taken from his victims. He was still somebody's neighbor. They had his voice on tape calling in one of his murders in 1977. They had his DNA. He had sent them a biographical chapter from a book he said he was writing about himself called The BTK Files. They had so many clues that the Wichita police became a laughingstock. But no one was laughing, least of all me. When the article was published in 1974, I received some threatening calls. I didn't know, were they cranks, or was BTK stalking me now? When the killer resurfaced last year, they started again, this time from internet chat rooms where I was vilified for protecting my source, where someone even suggested that I should be hung. Last spring, I was back in Wichita, caring for a sick friend when BTK returned to the scene, claiming a victim police had not attributed to him way back in 1986, and he included photos of her dying to prove it. It felt like 1974 again. My mother was also in the hospital, and I was afraid to stay in her big house alone. But I had to go in, get some clothes, feed the cat, do some chores. I couldn't seem to do it, though, especially when I discovered the front door had been left unlocked. With BTK's return, the local media were trying to find me and had left several calls on my mother's answering machine. If they could find me now, I reasoned, so could BTK. I asked a neighbor to go in the house with me. Flashlight in hand, we threw open each door, looking inside each closet. BTK had hidden in closets, surprising his victims. Of course we found nothing, and outside we laughed at ourselves. Today, Wichita is breathing again. The suspect has a face now. He has a name. He has a wife and two adult children. He is the president of his church congregation and has been a Cub Scout leader. He worked for the city for several years. My heart still skips when I think of BTK and what he did, of the families left behind who were victims as well. It is hard to believe that these horrible crimes might finally be solved. After all these years, there can be peace at last.
Kathy Henkel is sports editor at the Seattle Times. In 1974, she was a reporter with the now-defunct Wichita Sun. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.